Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's speaker is veteran PBS journalist and author Gwen Ifill.
As moderator and managing editor of Washington Week and senior correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, Gwen Ifill reports on a wide range of issues, offering analysis and interviewing national and international newsmakers. In addition, she's covered six presidential campaigns and moderated two vice presidential debates, one in 2004 between Dick Cheney and John Edwards, the other in 2008 between then-Senator Joe Biden and then-Governor Sarah Palin. On Washington Week, Gwen leads a roundtable discussion with award-winning journalists who report on the major stories coming out of the nation's capital. In its 42nd year on the air, the show is the longest-running primetime news and public affairs program on television. The first female and first African-American to moderate Washington Week, our speaker is also the best-selling author of The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. The fifth of six children of immigrant parents, her father was born in Panama, her mother in Barbados. Gwen is a native of New York City, graduated from Simmons College in Boston. From early childhood, she wanted to be a journalist, and she started her career as a reporter for the Boston Herald American. She went on to work for the Baltimore Evening Sun, was a national political reporter for the Washington Post, and was White House correspondent for the New York Times. Prior to joining PBS in 1999, she served as chief congressional and political correspondent for NBC News. And while she views public broadcasting as providing the depth of newspapers with the immediate impact of broadcast television, she says her first love was newspapers. Gwen has received much recognition and many awards for her work and is the recipient of more than 20 honorary doctorates. She serves on the boards of the News Literacy Project, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and she is a fellow with the American Academy of Sciences. Today, she will speak about politics, policy, reality, and what's really going on in Washington. I should ask that as a question. Gwen, what really is going on in Washington? Please join me in welcoming Gwen Ifill.
Maybe you can tell me. I'm looking forward to your questions. Maybe some of you can fill me in. I'm always actually happy to get out of Washington, and I'm especially when it comes when I get to come to a city like Indianapolis, which has such a strong tradition of public broadcasting. Yay, WFYI. Yay. It's my chance to be in touch with my people. As you may have heard, some of us in public media have come under fire again. So I'm here to tell you, thank you for your support. And if you want to make a phone call, that's okay too. And also, I've come to discover as I've traveled the country that public television and public radio listeners and viewers are exactly the smartest people in the world. So if you're not watching already. So I have a few things to say, and then I'd love to take your questions, but I have to get a few of them out of the way first, a few that I can anticipate. There are a couple of things you're going to ask me, I can tell. You're going to want to know if Washington is as screwed up as it looks. The short answer is nothing could be as screwed up as it looks. But more on that in a moment. You'll want to know if journalism is hopelessly out of whack. And the short answer is no, in fact, we are a lot less screwed up than we look. I'll get back to that in a moment as well. You will want to know whether Jim Lehrer is as cool as he seems. And I'm here to tell you more. But I couldn't tell you more than that, or I'd have to shoot you. We in Washington have just narrowly averted a government shutdown. The Supreme Court ruled yesterday that it's okay for a Kansas church to picket at military funerals. And most shocking, just like here in Indiana, we seem to have acquired a flock of new lawmakers who seem determined to try to do what they campaigned on. But I know the real question you want to ask me more than any other question today is whether I really, really, really liked it when Queen Latifah played me on Saturday Night Live. Hey, let's rip that question up. The short answer is I loved it, because why not? That was really fun, and that was the best part, actually, of moderating that debate. So now consider this. If you are a political junkie, if you like seeing the world, the wheels of government turn, if you believe they actually can, if you believe that full-throated, spirited public debate is what the founding fathers had in mind when they wrote the Constitution, then this is the time to start paying attention. We get fresh evidence of this every day, not only in Washington, but also around the world. Who among us has not been amazed at what we've been watching unfold in Egypt, in Libya, in Yemen, Tunisia? Look at what happened here in Indiana in the last election, where every Republican got reelected and 10 incumbent Democrats were defeated. It wasn't exactly a revolution, but tell that to the Democrats. It's as if everyone everywhere is reconsidering government. We watched in astonishment as lawmakers fled the Wisconsin and Indiana state capitals rather than be backed into a corner on legislation they didn't believe in. And in Washington, we've seen history set on rewind as Democrats and Republicans have been playing a gigantic game of chicken about shutting down the government. The president signed a two-week extension yesterday, which means that in 2 weeks we'll be having this fight all over again. Now, these are wildly different conflicts from what we've seen unfolding in the Middle East and Northern Africa, but at the root of it all, it's much the same. Individuals and governments who have decided that compromise is for chumps. There are winners and there are losers, but there is precious little middle ground. A recent edition of National Journal captured this exactly. It's what I had long suspected, that partisanship and polarization have reached epic levels in today's Washington, and the middle has simply disappeared. Now, National Journal has been ranking members of Congress on a scale of liberal to conservative since 1982. This time, the polar opposites in the Senate are Arizona's John McCain and seven others on the right, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and eight others on the left. But the most interesting discovery is that the most moderate members of Congress still remain well apart on ideological grounds. No Republican senator, including the well-known moderates like Maine's Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins and Ohio's now-retired George Voinovich, none of them was as liberal last year as the chamber's most conservative Democrat, Ben Nelson of Nebraska. Now, over in the House, there was a little bit more ideological overlap, but not by much. After the 2010 midterm elections, only one Republican, Walter Jones of North Carolina, compiled a voting record that could be considered moderate. Now, National Journal's rankings are based solely on a lawmaker's voting record, which does not take into account efforts that happen behind the scene. Many elected officials do make to reach middle ground before the standoffs happen. But these standoffs over budget cuts demonstrates that there appears to be little reward, little incentive for getting to common ground. Republican House Speaker John Boehner actually provided the most unintentionally illuminating window into this when he repeatedly refused in a 60 Minutes interview to allow Leslie Stahl to force him to even use the word compromise. He told her, well, when you say the word compromise, a lot of Americans look up and go, uh-oh, they're going to sell me out. And so finding common ground, he says, I think makes more sense. Now, the difference between common ground and compromise, I'm not sure I get the distinction, and most Americans probably don't either. There's a political scientist, Gary Jacobson. He told the National Journal that the basic movement is toward the parties moving further and further apart. As it happens, in that same edition of National Journal, there was this amazing photograph. It was from 1988. Sitting in the front was then Minority Leader Bob Dole, seated across the table from then Majority Leader Robert Byrd, and sitting behind, they were calling President Reagan to talk about some treaty that the Senate had just ratified, and sitting behind them, standing behind them, were eight other members of the Senate. Four Democrats, four Republicans, all of them smiling to beat the band. Now, I can't even imagine in my mind, in my wildest fantasy, such a picture being able to be taken today. And by the way, the one person in that photograph who is still serving in the United States Senate, Dick Lugar. So we watched the push and the pull between parties in Congress and with the White House and in state governments from coast to coast, and we see truth as well as consequences over budgets and spending and at its root over our priorities. But before you sneer about government gridlock and say nothing ever gets done, you have to think about it the way I do, which is at this moment, we have a clearer sense than we have ever had what it means to have checks and balances. Sometimes it means you freeze. Sometimes. Shouldn't be all the time. The challenge, therefore, is laid out right in front of us, and that's where you come in. You have to participate. You have to listen. You have to question. You have to even yell a little bit, even though it seems like you're getting the yelling part fine across the street. Over on Washington Week and on the NewsHour, we don't much yell, but we do approach the news with a fairly simple premise. We assume that you can decide what you think if we simply give you the information to work with. We are not to be confused with cable television. We hope you never know what we actually think about anything, or that we reach any personal conclusions at all. But we believe that you are hungry to know, that the rigors of daily life don't entirely obliterate the need for information that is occurring beyond our neighborhoods. It's a different landscape than when I first began working in journalism years ago. I used to just say it, now I kind of don't. My first four jobs, as you heard, were at newspapers. That was the way we got information when I was growing up, so I've just given my age away, and I'm going to give it away some more. I lived in Buffalo, so if Buffalo Evening News said there was a Santa Claus, could have been 9 years old, I thought there was a Santa Claus. Okay, this is where I give it up. Chet Huntley and Walter Cronkite said, if they told me someone had just been assassinated, well, that was real news, too. That was a sober reality. That was something I needed to know. But who knew that by now, in this point in my career, when I'm still so incredibly young, yeah, I didn't like the fact you didn't laugh very hard at that right away. Who knew that newspapers would be struggling, that they would be contracting, that television news divisions would be placing all of their bets on how best to deliver news over the cell phone, and that even though there are cable channels which say they are devoted to news, that so much of what they put on the air would be about missing cheerleaders and Charlie Sheen. I bet we all know a lot more about Charlie Sheen than we hope we had to. Perhaps you've noticed that in the age of cable news and online news feeds, there is a 24-hour beast that needs to be fed. And as a result, there are certain stories out there that smolder and burn and explode, and then they die out, usually in the span 7 days. Remember Terry Jones? You can be forgiven if you don't, because his week in the spotlight began and ended with his misguided but compulsively covered effort to burn a Koran last September. That's right. The controversy that he generated, which grew to involve the commentary of General David Petraeus, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and even the president, was, you will forgive me, gone in a flash. But that didn't stop us from briefly elevating him and his dubious cause to an alarming degree, one that worried Muslims at home and confirmed worse suspicions abroad. Then, just before last Thanksgiving, we had another one of those flash-in-the-pan moments. You will recall it was a little faux controversy over TSA pat-downs. Even as we all debated the issue ad nauseum in the days leading up to the biggest travel day of the year, I remember sailing through airports on my appointed rounds, accompanied by hundreds of fellow travelers who were managing to do the same thing. Now, we were unmolested, by the way, and there were horror stories. They were very evocative, the stripped-down children, the violated mastectomy patients, and the chinos-wearing men who are protective of their junk, that lovely, elegant term. But the reality was less horrible. A scheduled traveler's uprising failed to materialize, proving that most travelers were mostly eager to get over the river and through the woods to Grandma's house and not to get part in a Twitter-fueled controversy. But even though we all, in my business, sometimes get carried away, it's become clear we can't afford to look away. The debates about war and peace and terrorism, they're good for politics and they're good for the news business, but I think they're also good for civil society as well. For me, that means that at the Washington Week Roundtable, we populate it with reporters who cover the White House and Congress and the Pentagon, State Department, the economy, politics, and it's gotten even more stimulating than usual. But lately, we've discovered it's also getting tougher and tougher to know what the right questions are and to get them answered. As the news gets more and more urgent and international challenges increase, the questions seem to get harder and harder to answer. Politicians have figured out that most people, and most of the people I've met get into politics for the most noble of reasons. They want to represent their neighbors, they want to change the world, or they want to change the law. Or at least, at the very least, or maybe at the most, they want a bully pulpit. Surely a concept that is rooted in and protected by the Constitution. What's important about this is that everything is politics. Politics determines whether children get to go to school or not, how much their teachers are paid, what sort of education they receive, whether they go to war when they grow up or go to graduate school, whether they go to the Peace Corps or to Wall Street. Now, all of this could make you cynical, and being a journalist has taught me the distinction, however, between cynicism and skepticism, and how to recognize when it helps to have a little bit of both. I considered myself to be a skeptic, not a cynic, which means that I always have a question for you. I don't take anything at face value. A cynic means you've already decided what you think and you don't really want to hear anymore. A skeptic always has more questions. Being that way has taught me that the best lessons aren't necessarily learned from the people with the most power and the loftiest titles, but sometimes just by keeping your ears open and writing it all down. I frequently get another question that people ask me, who's the most, I guess they mean famous, but they say, what's the best interview you've ever done? And it's not the presidents, it's not the world leaders, it's not the celebrities. It's always someone who told me something I hadn't heard before or thought of that way. It's the guy in the Union bomber jacket in the Piggly Wiggly in Ohio who had been unemployed for 11 months and I wanted to know who he was going to vote for in the year 2004. And he said, I thought this is a Kerry voter. He's a union guy, he's a steel worker, right? No, he was going to vote for George W. Bush. And when I asked him why, he said, because I trust him. I found out on election day that's why a lot of people voted to reelect President Bush that year. There was something instinctively they trusted. On the day that President Obama was inaugurated, on that freezing cold day on the National Mall, I remember going from person to person and asking them why they were there and what this meant to them. And at the very end of the day, when I was really done because I was cold, I looked up at just as the oath of office was being sworn, and I saw a woman fall to her knees and start sobbing. She was head to toe clad in something leopard print. But I walked up to her and I said, what? And she looked at me and it was so cold, the tears were freezing on her face. She said, you know, I never thought I'd live to see this day. I got on a bus, I came here from Oklahoma. I have a teenage boy who now has other choices. And I look up at that man and I think, my son could do that. And she started crying again. That to me was the most incredible exchange of that day, on that big historic day when so much else was happening. So on our best days, the essence of the reporter's craft is learning all you can about something that never necessarily previously interested you, and then find a way to make it accessible to anyone who bothers to listen. That's what I do every night on the News Hour, and that's what I do in what I call it my sandbox on Friday nights on Washington Week. It doesn't matter what the topic might be. Tomorrow night we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court ruling having to do with allowing the Westboro Church in Kansas picket military funerals, something most everyone I know finds hateful, but which the Supreme Court, for interesting reasons, upheld as within the confines of the First Amendment. We're going to talk about this budget standoff in Washington and the degree to which there's something that can move. And we're going to talk about the degree to which Washington has its hands tied behind its back in Libya as it watches and apparently helplessly as that civil war breaks out. But you get to play with all these stories, and I get to explain why they matter and how important it is, not just that it's important. And then you do what you want with the information we provide. Any way you choose to get your information, you can get your information. It's just that no one is going to be force-feeding you anymore. Chet Huntley just isn't there. You should treat your government the same way. The information and the access is there. You just have to learn how to use it. I went to the Library of Congress recently to meet with a group of incoming chiefs of staff for freshman members of Congress. Many of them had never held any public office before they came to Washington, many of them part of the Tea Party wave. I figured at this orientation lunch, which was sponsored by the Congressional Management Foundation, it'd be a handy way for me to check out the newcomers. And I knew that something interesting was about to happen when the executive director of the foundation went to the microphone and said, "Welcome to Washington." And everybody froze. It occurred to me that everybody in that room had been running against Washington for so long that they were slightly stunned to actually be there. And the truth is, it's hard for politicians who in many cases have been running against the evil government to roll into the nation's capital and suddenly discover they are the evil government. I tried to be gentle with them. I tried to warn them that the budget would not be balanced in a week and health care would not be replaced and repealed right away. And in fact, on the same day that we were consuming our chicken salad, the lawmakers were across the street reelecting the new leadership, which looked a lot like the old: Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, John Boehner. And in spite of all that, however, I think we're living in a transformational time. 9/11 transformed us. It shifted our priorities and our expectations of our government. So too did the 2008 election year. No matter the outcome, we became invested in it. The results of the 2010 midterm elections may yield the same result, more evidence of our investment, or it may teach us all over again about the costs of sitting on the sidelines. Because investment is what we all need, whether the plan is to change the world at large or just to cope with the world around us. We can celebrate the time we live in, or we can despair that we are on the wrong path. I wrote a book a few years ago about candidates who break through and make history. The folks I wrote about are smart, motivated, engaged. They are people who figured out that going along to get along is not the formula for success. They're leaders who figured out that someone would always tell them no, that someone would always tell them that they are not something enough, that the goals that seemed out of reach were worth reaching for anyway, and that it is no one else's fault, it is their responsibility. Given that, you still have to beware of the magic wand, as many of these breakthroughs have found out. The idea that we will get where we want to go without effort is a false one. That's never going to happen. We have to work at it. All those newcomers to Washington, they have to work doubly hard if they want to keep the promises that they made when they got them elected. Sometimes change happens overnight, sometimes it happens over time, but it seldom happens in an orderly way. I'll leave you with this story and then I'll take your questions. When I was growing up, one of my favorite books was Winnie the Pooh. Kind of still is. I think I found something very appealing about the contrast between Pooh's kind of even sunniness and Tigger's antic excitement and Eeyore's depressive nature. Pooh's author, A.A. Milne, understood the benefits of the unlikely combination. He said, one of the advantages of being disorderly is that one is constantly making exciting discoveries. I think about that when I look at my desk. Now, I guess I'm a journalist because I always think there are new and exciting discoveries just around the corner. Discoveries in an age where everyone has an opinion, but so little is new and so much is trite. Discoveries in an age when we are bombarded with so much information and so little news. Discoveries in a time when so much of what passes for inspiration lacks true insight. And discoveries that move us to seize responsibility rather than to grudgingly fulfill obligation. I could be cynical. I've been in Washington long enough. It's an occupational hazard, but I'm not. Because we journalists, no less than the average American voter, are out here looking for something authentic. I travel the country. I try to listen to what people are saying outside of my bubble, what they are thinking about, how they are coping when they don't know if the plant will close, whether their 401k will pay off, whether an out-of-the-blue medical surprise will bankrupt them. I try to listen. And yet, I still remain a political junkie. Because you don't have to be a political junkie to believe the wheels of government can turn. Sometimes you have to force the wheels to turn, but they can. I thank you for the honor of speaking to you, and I really look forward to your questions.
All right. Thank you, Gwen. We have several questions. If you have more, please bring them up to the head table, and we'll ask as many as we can. You commented early on about the importance of support for public broadcasting. Would you comment a little bit more? How important is it that NewsHour remain commercial-free?
Thank you for asking that. I did not write the question. I did not plant the question, I believe, is what you're all thinking. I worked for, as I mentioned, I worked for four newspapers, and I also worked for NBC News for 5 years. So I have a little sense of the dark side of broadcasting, which is to say the commercial end. And I am happy to say that in all my years in journalism, I've never felt like anyone walked up to me and said, you know, here's the corporate reason why you have to cover this story or don't cover this story or tell the story that way. At the same time, I didn't realize until I got to public broadcasting what a lovely cushion commercial broadcasting provided from the pressures. Even though you only had a minute and a half to tell a story, you also had advertising, which meant that you didn't have to raise money. You didn't have to depend on people like you to write checks. You didn't have to depend on pledge drives. And so there were certainly business pressures, but not the kind that we sustain. One of the questions I get the most about this whole dispute about government funding is, well, we think Big Bird is great, but why should we pay for them? And in fact, the business model has changed a lot in the time that we've all grown up watching public television. There are other places to get children's programming, other places to get your news. But there are no other safe places for your children to watch television without having things sold to them. There are no other places where you can find that a short story at the NewsHour is 5 minutes, not a minute. And a long story, if it's worth it, can go on and deeper and smarter. In addition to that, the reason why I believe that federal support through the Corporation of Public Broadcasting is essential because it provides the seed money for us to allow to get leverage to get other kinds of funding. You'll watch at the end of our programs, you know, this program brought to you by this, this, and this, and sometimes it begins to feel a little bit like an ad, but what it is a way of showing that we have support and that the federal underpinning, which is only a couple percent of our budget, by the way, as quietly as it's kept, but it provides the seed that allows us to build. So I think in order for us to do more, I think actually the moment we are in right now, and especially in news and public affairs, cries out for more support, not less, more understanding, not less, and I hope you agree with that.
Do the congressional leaders genuinely dislike each other as much as it appears on television?
Some of them, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was talking about that photograph that I saw, and the interesting thing about that picture is you get the feeling they all wanted to be there, that they were all going to go out and have a beer after it was over. That doesn't happen as much anymore, I'm told. And one of the reasons it doesn't happen is because the structure of Washington has changed. A lot of the lawmakers who come to Washington used to live there, stay there, hang out together. Their families got to know each other. Now it's considered a bad thing for you to want to live in Washington, so people are less likely to see each other. One of the things I like to do is I like to watch when there's a vote on the House or Senate floor. It's the one time where you see in public all of the different lawmakers from different parties actually arrive in the same place at the same time, and I'm always struck by how surprised they seem to see each other. I'm like, aren't you members of the same club? Why are you just... And they linger, and they talk, and they chat, and you can tell a lot of deals are being done because the rest of their lives off the floor in their offices, in their bubbles, and in their party caucuses, frankly, there's no advantage in talking across party lines anymore. I don't necessarily believe it's personal. But I do think that, as a result, it takes a lot longer and it becomes a lot more complicated for things that seem fairly simple to get done.
Has the 24-hour news cycle accelerated history? Think Egypt.
That's an excellent question. I believe it has. When you stop and think about it, this is not the first time there have been upheavals. This is not the first time there have been revolutions. But we... being able to watch it in real time has transformed. I believe that if Mubarak were not on Al Jazeera cable, that he would still be in office. I think that office, I guess you could call it office when you've been there for 30 years without a vote. he's not be still in power. I think that it would not have spread from nation to nation to nation the way it has to unlikely places if people had not witnessed the possibilities of standing up and rising up. I also think, however, that the downside of that is we expect things to happen right away. I've been watching with, you know, some mild amusement as the president's critics say, well, why won't he do something? Well, I'm not certain what the president of the United States is supposed to do in Yemen. I'm not supposed, short of putting troops on the ground, which I get the feeling we don't want him to do, I'm not certain what we're supposed to do. We're used to the United States being able to speak and having this big gavel to force action. But I'm not certain the world is that way anymore. But the 24-hour news cycle makes it seem as it ought to be, as if something ought to happen. I trace a lot of this back to O.J., now, bear with me on this. Remember when O.J. happened? Huh? And it was that unfolding soap opera day after day after day, starting with the white Bronco, and what happens next, and where is he going to go, and did he do it, and oh, the glove didn't fit. But every single day you turned on to watch it, it was literally like watching a soap opera. And we got spoiled with the idea that every story had to be an unfolding soap opera, a court trial. There was a whole court TV sprung up out of that. We had to suddenly watch dramas unfold. I knew that we had reached a point where we wanted that too much, where we wanted the unexpected dramatic result too much. When I was covering the impeachment of a president in 1996, and my bosses were bored with the story because they knew how it was going to turn out. We have gotten addicted to the idea that every story is an unfolding saga. And as a result, I think we do not appreciate sometimes change for its own sake, that it doesn't necessarily end, it doesn't often does not end up in a happy ending, and it doesn't end up with an ending at all. Sometimes it just ends with a whimper. So I worry a little bit that we are too addicted to the idea that everything has got to be a story and not just what it is.
Thank you. A question about the debates.
No embarrassing questions yet, even though this debate one may get me there. Go ahead.
How much authority does the moderator have to get candidates to stick to specific issues or the question asked?
That's not embarrassing, but it's puzzling. We were talking about it a little bit up here. I moderated two vice presidential debates. The one in 2004, which no one remembers, was Dick Cheney and John Edwards. I would ask them different questions today. Never mind. The second one was Sarah Palin and Joe Biden. Was the one a lot of people, 67 million people, I believe, watched. Not that I was counting. The interesting thing about those debates is that, first of all, you can't lobby to moderate a debate. They have to decide and come to you, and it's a very mysterious process. And they offer you, and you say, thank you very much, and then you're left on your own. Jim Lehrer had moderated 10 of these, at least, by the time I moderated my first, and so I actually went to him for advice and said, what should I do? And he said, well, you should come up with your own question and keep them to yourself. What he meant by that, and he was correct, is that all the campaigns had someone whose full-time job was to worry about what you were going to ask and try to anticipate it. And so I had to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what are the questions, especially in a vice presidential debate, which, by the way, there's only one, so you're tasked with talking about foreign policy and domestic policy. It's the only chance anyone's going to get to look at the person who might be a heartbeat away. So I felt this responsibility to get all of these questions in, but to ask them in a way that might be illuminating. Now, there are a couple things that happen here. One is I come up with smart questions, I think. The other is that I don't believe it's my job to chase them around the table. I have incredible faith, which has always been served me well, that people know when a question's not being answered. So in 2004, I remember thinking, I want to ask a question about AIDS. At the time, everybody was talking about AIDS in Africa and the Millennium Challenge grants and things like that. And I thought, well, I want to ask them a question which might get a different answer. So I'd seen a story about the incredible increase in infection rates among heterosexual women in the United States, African-American women mostly. And I thought, I'll ask them about that. And I prefaced the question by saying, I'm going to ask you this, but I don't want you to talk about Africa. I want you to talk about something that's happening right here. And I laid it out. And the response from Dick Cheney was something along the lines of, really, I didn't know that. That was it. And the response from John Edwards was, well, let me tell you about my policy toward AIDS in Africa. Now, neither of them answered the question, and my option at that point was to say, but you didn't answer the question, and draw the attention to me and make it become the moderator's challenge, or you could trust that the people at home knew they did not answer the question and that this was how they prioritized this issue. And based on the reaction I got, a lot of it to this day from that question, I was completely justified in the way I handled it, which is I don't chase them around the table. Now, the one time I must admit I had a second thought about whether I may have said to Sarah Palin, well, yeah, you do have to answer the moderator's questions, but I kind of made the decision that, once again, I was not the story, and that people watching at home, when she said, I don't have to answer the moderator's stories, would know, the moderator's questions, would think to themselves, really? I thought that was the whole point. And I let it speak for itself.
What do you think are some of the most overreported or underreported stories coming out of Washington?
That's a hard one, because most of the overreported, I was going for Charlie Sheen, but okay. Most of the overreported stories are stories where we get a little caught up in things we know are not going to happen. We get caught up in artificial debates between people who you know are not really debating each other, they're just making a point. We get caught up in the drumbeat of who's going to run for president, who's not, when we know that for a lot of people it's just a question of getting bigger speaking fees and getting around the country and not actually leading, because you can tell from their answers to questions whether they're actually interested in doing what it takes to be president, which is extremely difficult. But we get caught up in the drumbeat. The undercover stories are always about the people who don't have anyone to speak for them. They're always about people who are just trying every single day to get up, do the best, get their kids educated, maybe create a nest egg, and go back and do it all over again. Now, the reason those stories get undercovered, of course, is my when chickens fly theory of journalism, which is that we all know that chickens don't fly, right? We do know that, don't we? Okay. And if a chicken were to fly, if a chicken crosses the street, it's at the natural order of things. It's the way it's supposed to be. But if a chicken were to suddenly fly, that would be news. And so, therefore, that's the definition of something new and unexpected, and it's on page one the next day. The expected, the getting up every day, the doing your job, the trying to make ends meet, the teaching the kids, the kid who becomes the valedictorian is not the headline, the kid who becomes the murderer, or better yet, the murdering valedictorian becomes the story because it's something that was unexpected. So I think that's where we fall down, actually, largely in our business, that we don't tell the stories that need to be told, and it's harder to do it.
Thank you. You mentioned Senator Lugar in your remarks, and that he's the only person among those eight who is still serving. And there's a question here about how do you view Senator Lugar?
A scholar and a gentleman. Senator Lugar is incredibly well-liked in Washington across both sides of the aisle, partly because he's been doing it so long, but also because he is an unrivaled expert in the areas of in the questions of nuclear energy and nuclear arms. And he has never, I don't think I've ever heard him yell. Have you ever heard him yell? Have you ever heard of an incident in which he had a shouting match with a colleague? Have you ever heard him not to be, he is now the walking, breathing, living embodiment of the ideal we say we want from our lawmakers, which is people who actually speak to one another. He is that in an age in which that is no longer as prized as it once was, which is why he may have a challenge if he chooses to run again here. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who says, oh, that Lugar, I can't stand him. You don't really get that about him.
Thank you. And what should higher education be doing to better prepare our students to take their part in the future?
I may punt this one, but I'm going to punt at length. Because it's not, I really do believe there are people in this room who know the answer to that question and who do this for a living. I merely write about it or talk about it or ask as many questions as possible about it. Sometimes it looks like an expert when you see me on TV, but in fact I'm not. One thing I do is I deeply appreciate and value the contributions made by people who are doing what we need for our future. That's where education, it seems to me, comes in, and where it's tied into everything else we're talking about, whether it's about recovering the economy, whether it's about finding a way to spread our wealth, whether no matter what it is, you have to start with an educated populace, and any business leader will tell you that, and any educator will tell you that, but we struggle. We struggle with it. We struggle with the best way to do it. We struggle with a way to make sure that a broader swath of young people can benefit from it. I am gratified when I go to college campuses and find that people still want to do public service. I find that to be a great relief because it means there's hope for a future and ways to build on that. One of the reasons I think we have had this interesting flare-up in union activity and protests around the country is because at the heart of it are teachers, and teachers are somehow caught up in this definitional struggle about what they are and what they do and how they do what they do. And everybody identifies with that. Everyone has had a teacher. And so we struggle with that, but as we should. We should be constantly figuring out how do we redefine, how do we speak to the needs which have changed from the time that I was in college and changed from the time most of us were in college. And we have to find a way to do that. I think that's where higher education comes in, not just in the four-year level, but especially at community colleges.
Gwenaeth, well, thank you so much for your very interesting and thoughtful remarks.
You've been listening to Gwen Ifill, managing editor and senior correspondent for PBS and host of Washington Week in Review. Coming up next time on the Economic Club of Indiana, Gary Becker, Nobel Prize winner in economics, once a student of Milton Friedman, who encouraged his use of economic theory to promote social change. Becker will speak on the slow recovery and long-run challenges to the American economy. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Alseth.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.